The Andy Pollin Show on ESPN 630 starts right now.
All right, we're going for 3 hours today. Tony is off, but Tony and Mike weighed in on the decision to start Sam Howell on Sunday, and we're going to play some of that for you coming up. Last couple of days have been dominated by the discussion of DeMar Hamlin and the condition that he is in and the impact that it's having on the NFL. And there really isn't much to update today, but Adam Schefter sent out this tweet about an hour ago. DeMar Hamlin's father, Mario Hamlin, addressed the entire Bills team on a Zoom call yesterday to personally update everyone in attendance on his son, per source. Mario Hamlin informed the Bills that DeMar was making progress, and in the words of one source, the team needed it. So signs are going in the right direction, which is obviously great. The question is, when will he be out of intensive care? When will we know about the long-term prognosis? Well, we don't know any of that stuff right now. And a lot of this is having an impact on what the NFL is trying to figure out what to do. Now, it's Thursday morning. Games are supposed to be played on Saturday afternoon going into Sunday. Is it too late to call off this week? It may not be. Discussions are ongoing to the point where they may get some kind of an announcement today that, hey, we're not going to play anything this weekend. We've got the week to play with between the championships and the Super Bowl, and we'll just move everything up and play next week. Now, I don't know what that means for completing the Bills and the Bengals game, which has an impact a lot of different ways, and we'll talk about that coming up. But according to Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk, who's pretty well plugged in, it's still in play that Week 18 could be moved from this weekend to the following weekend, and everything would be moved up. The Super Bowl would still be played on time. It's very, very difficult to move that. They did it in 2001, but made the decision much earlier in the season. That was a decision probably came October, about a month after 9/11, so there is not as much time to change all the logistics for this game this year. It's in Arizona, and I don't think that they'll be able to do anything on that. So we'll keep you updated on anything that happens. I'm following Twitter and following the wires and all that, and if something breaks on that, we'll talk about it. We'll get to the Howell discussion here in a moment, but I want to begin with this today, and I watched some of this game last night. Georgetown lost its 25th consecutive Big East game. That is now a record that they did not want. Last time they won a Big East game was March 2nd, 2021. So we're coming up now on 2 years since they won a game. And while nothing really is changing much with the program, there was a development yesterday which was very curious, very curious. Here's Georgetown getting ready to play Villanova at home. It's a home game. And in the afternoon, the athletic director for the school, Lee Reed, releases a statement. It's not a press conference, just puts out a statement. And he said, "We recognize this is a challenging and frustrating time for the men's basketball team and our fans. Coach Ewing understands that it is imperative to get the program back on track, and no one is more committed than he is to making that happen." That is a warning shot. That is, when you say imperative, that is, okay, we've put you on notice here, coach, that things have to turn around or we're going to have to make a change. It's a change that nobody wants to make. Patrick Ewing is the greatest player in the history of the program. He put that team on his back and took it to 3 championship games, winning one of them. I mean, all that Georgetown is as a school, certainly as a basketball program, a big part of it is Patrick Ewing's legacy. But the fact of the matter is, team isn't good. And in an arena that holds over 20,000, they drew just over 7,000 fans for a Big East game last night. That's just not working. And that's one of the reasons that Patrick Ewing is there, because John Thompson III, at the end of his run, was rolling up records that were similar to what Ewing is doing, not as bad, but more importantly, nobody was showing up at the arena. So they wanted to put some life back in the program. John Thompson II, who built that from the ground up, and, they I think rightly so, looked at his legacy and wanted to honor it, and really took somebody from the family. John Thompson III, obviously, but became the fourth coach to succeed John Thompson. First, there was Craig Escherich, or rather the third coach to succeed him, Craig Escherich, John Thompson III, and then Patrick Ewing, who's sort of the family. But, you know, Georgetown had made this run into the tournament 2 years ago. They had a bad regular season, but they managed to win the tournament. And so that got him in, and that gave Patrick Ewing an extension, which they didn't want to pay off. And they don't want to go through the embarrassment of firing the greatest player in the history of the program. I think that has a lot to do with it. So after Georgetown lost, and they've had a lot of games like this, this was a tie game at the half. And in the second half, they just nothing. They shot 21% from the field, including 2 of 10 from 3. In the second half. And they were shorthanded. They played the game without guards, Wayne Bristol Jr. and Jay Heath. That's understandable. But it's a game that you were in at the half, and this is not the Villanova teams of the past where, you know, they're contending for the national championship and won a couple of them under Jay Wright. This is kind of a down year for them. And first year that Wright is out of the program, and it was a game that they had a chance to win and just, you know, second half just ran out of gas, 16-point loss. So after the game, this was Ewing talking to reporters, and this was Kareem Copeland of the Washington Post with the first question.
I hate to kind of start things off on this note, but today was a record 25th straight loss in Big East play. The Reed earlier today put out a statement saying it's imperative to get the program back on track. Have you guys, has he expressed those concerns with you? And are you concerned about your future at the helm of this program?
Hey, look, I'm here to talk about the game. You know, my future is my future. I'm here to coach I'll be the head coach at Georgetown until, you know, the president or the board decide for me to move on. But until that time, you know, a friend of mine sent me a quote today. It's not how many times you get knocked down, it's how many times you get up. We got knocked down, so all we're gonna do is keep on getting up.
How do you get this program back on track?
Well, first of all, we got to get back healthy. We get back healthy, and then we see what happens after that.
Okay, well, that's, you know, what you would expect him to say. He's not going to say, well, I wish, you know, Lee Reed hadn't delivered a 2x4 to my head 2 hours before I'm going out to coach against Villanova. But the reality is, even John Thompson said this when Patrick Ewing was hired. He said the reality is that if Patrick doesn't win, he's going to get fired. And maybe he would have been fired had he not made that run in the NCAA tournament or to the NCAA tournament 2 years ago. But since then, nothing. Winless in the Big East last year, winless in the Big East this year, 0-5. The team is 5-11 after winning a total of only 6 games last year. Change is coming. And that was Lee Reed saying, unless we have a miraculous turnaround in the second half of the season, that's it for Patrick Ewing. That word will be remembered. Imperative that things turn around. And if they don't, well, obviously. And Ewing knows the score. He knows how it works, and he understands it. And I think what he explained there was he's there until the president of the school decides that he's not there anymore. Yesterday in the morning, we got a report that Taylor Heinicke was going to start at quarterback on Sunday. I forget who had it first. Jeremy Fowler, one of the reporters for ESPN, said that he had heard that it was going to be Heinicke. And then the day goes on, and the team practices, and Ron Rivera finally holds his news conference after practice and then says this about his starting quarterback.
Our plans is we're going to start with Sam. You know, I spoke with the coaches, talked to some of the team leaders, and talked with some others about it. And we feel that this is an opportunity for us to give Sam a chance to show us what he's capable of. I think that, you know, the opportunity is going to be a good one for him to go out and play football and, you know, just kind of show us. I mean, you know, we're not going to judge everything on Sam based on just one game. But we are going to get an opportunity to see him and see how he prepares and gives himself the opportunity to play.
Now, he did admit that he thought about starting Heinicke, and we'll play some of that audio a little bit later on. But he consulted with other people on the team, including the team leaders, and I think he's right in saying, look, you know, maybe it's not the best circumstance to throw him in there against a Cowboy team that has something to play for. But, you know, we're going to find out. So let's put him out there and see what happens. Now, we know that Carson Wentz is not going to get a uniform because Heinicke will be the backup. Rivera confirmed that. And that essentially ends it. He had 7 starts, played in 8 games, won 2 of them. His last time out, horrendous. He threw 3 interceptions. He was sacked 3 times in an ugly loss to a team that isn't going anywhere. A chance at home to keep themselves on track to make the playoffs, and now the season is kaput. It's a meaningless game on Sunday. Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon actually led off yesterday's show on PTI talking about the move to Sam Howell. Well, Mike Wilbon is totally aligned with Tom Lavero of the Washington Times, who wrote that in the Times yesterday, that should be it. That should be the last straw for Ron Rivera, making the move to Carson Wentz when it was known in the locker room that Heinicke was better liked, that they had a better chance to win, and he stubbornly went to Wentz, and it was a disaster, and that should cost him his job. Barry Zwerluga, pretty much on the same page, column today in the Post, Rivera hasn't been the solution, but a change might be possible. He writes, the damning elements of Ron Rivera's tenure as coach of Washington's NFL franchise have added up. In a normal town with a normal team at a normal time, firing him with 2 years left on a 5-year deal would seem, well, normal. But he also points out that Dan Snyder is in a position now where he really can't be looking to hire his 11th head coach in 23 years of ownership, and you don't want to pay off 2 years of a contract and dump that on whoever's going to buy the team. And this is what happens all the time when companies are sold. They want to make the payroll look a little bit better and, you know, give the option of the new owner, assuming that all this happens in the offseason. I mean, we may go through another year of this mishigas. Who knows? But assuming the team is sold in the offseason, you want to give the new owner the option of either keeping Ron Rivera. And you might want to do that. I mean, despite the record, and the record hasn't been good. I mean, this is his third year on the job, and he's won a total of 21 games, even with the expansion of 2 extra games in his second and third year. And you could certainly make the case, as Barry does, as Tom did yesterday, as Wilbon did emphatically there, that he has to go. But there are more extenuating circumstances here regarding the sale of the team. And, you know, Dan Snyder can't just be calling people up and say, hey, would you be interested in coaching my team, when the guy's got to say, hey, I don't know if I'm going to be working for you. I don't know if you're going to be the owner in 3 months. That doesn't make sense. The new guy may come in and go, what do you mean? I got this guy? Yeah. So it's an impossible situation. And Snyder, despite all the hiring of coaches, and as Barry says, 10 coaches there, he has never, as far as I know, paid off 2 full seasons. The only exception might be Marty Schottenheimer, who signed a 4-year deal, had 3 years left, but he went immediately to the San Diego Chargers and offset a lot of that money with the contract that he got. Snyder still had to pay out of pocket for a coach that wasn't coaching for him, but it's not like, you know, he gave Marty all 3 years that were left on the deal. And at that time, you know, it was a 4-year deal for $10 million. Now the going rate for a head coach in the NFL is probably between $7 and $10 million a year, maybe more. So paying off 2 years at whatever he's making, maybe he's making less than 7, but it's probably not a whole lot less than 7. It's not something that he's going to do, nor is he going to dump that on the new owner. So they may be stuck with him for a while. And just because there are reports that Dan Snyder could wrap up the sale of the team soon and this could all be approved at the owners' meetings in March, maybe, maybe not. We'll talk much more about the move to Sam Howell coming up. Also, Mike Florio with some thoughts on what might happen. It's Thursday again, and no guarantee we're going to have NFL this weekend. Everything's scheduled right now, but schedules can change. And the fortunate part is that all signs on Daron Hamlin, according to people who are close to him, are pointing in the right direction. But he's not out of the woods yet. And that will have a big impact on whether or not we have football this weekend. Coming up, Sonny Jurgensen's number will be retired on Sunday. I am probably in a small minority of fans old enough to have seen him play. Sonny played his last game 48 years ago. And Sonny has always been my favorite football player. I have followed his career ever since 1966. He came here in 64. To me, he is to Washington what Joe DiMaggio is to New York, what Joe DiMaggio is to baseball. And I'll talk about Sonny and play some of an interview that he did with the late, great Andy Ockershausen a few years ago, give you a little flavor for what fans who are there to see the Commanders. Unfortunately, most of them will be there to see Dallas, but fans who are there to see the Commanders, who they will be cheering for and honoring on Sunday. That's next. It's the Andy Pollin Show, ESPN 630.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts, and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the road to a podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching The Stacking Benjamins podcast wherever you listen.
The Andy Pollin Show on ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Heading towards noon today, Tony is off. Lots more on the move to Sam Howell as quarterback for Sunday. We'll talk about that. The possibility that we may not have football this weekend. All the ramifications of the schedule change and whether or not this Bills and Bengals game will be made up. All those things we'll get into a little bit later on. Also, on Sunday, as the Commanders close out the season with Howell as quarterback and Dallas with something to play for, it's all set up. So, you know, Philadelphia playing at the same time against the Giants, there is the slight possibility that Philadelphia would lose, although I don't see it happening with the Giants having nothing to play for. They've already clinched their playoff spot, and there's nowhere they can go up. So I don't think they're going to play all their regulars the whole game. So Philadelphia, I think, would win that, and they would clinch the division in the first round bye. But Dallas does have a shred of hope, and if Philadelphia falls, they could win the NFC East. So they're going to be playing to win the game, and I think that's going to bring out a lot of Cowboy fans on Sunday. I'd like to see some old-time Washingtonians out there to honor Sonny Jurgensen, whose number is being retired. And Sonny was not drafted by Washington. He came here in a trade, and he came here in a surprise trade. 1961, the then Redskins had drafted Norm Snead out of Wake Forest, and the team was bad. The team was terrible, but Snead was showing some promise, especially in his second year when finally this team integrated. And that's a long story about how that finally happened. The 15 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color line, the then Redskins finally integrated, the last major professional team to do that. And Bobby Mitchell, future Hall of Famer, came in, and some other minority players helped to get the team to be a little bit better. And Snead was showing like he was going to develop into a pretty good quarterback. And Sonny had been the backup to Norm Van Brocklin in 1960 when the Eagles won the championship. Van Brocklin retired after that game and went on to coach the Atlanta Falcons, and Sonny became the starter, and he was terrific. He set a record, I think, in his first year as a starter for most touchdown passes in a season. Doesn't sound like much now, but 32 was the record. And he looked like, well, he was, in fact, established as a great throwing quarterback. And he had, you know, Tommy McDonald, who is a Hall of Fame receiver. Pete Retzlaff, I think, is in the Hall of Fame. And it looked like they were going to build the team around him moving forward. And then in a stunner, on April Fool's Day, the then Redskins trade Norm Snead to the Philadelphia Eagles for Sonny Jurgensen. And Sonny recalled it several years back on a podcast that he did with Andy Ockershausen.
It was. I was surprised because I had just talked with the new head coach of the Philadelphia team, was Joe Koharik. And I had met with him, talked with him about what we were going to do and why we were going to win and how. And I was very excited about it, you know.
A new beginning for you, right?
And I walk out of there at 13th and Locust and walk to 18th and Spruce, which was a day's delicatessen. And I go in and some guys come in. I was meeting some friends there. Some guys come in and say, "Hey, I just see where you got traded." I said, "What? What are you talking about?" And I said, "I just met with the coach." I said, "I didn't get traded." And I said, "It was April Fool's Day." And I said, "It's April Fool's. That's the reason." And they said, "No, well, you just heard it on the radio."
You're gone.
So I go back around the 13th and Locust and run into the coach. And I said, "What is this? Traded?" He said, "Yep, we traded you. We got a good trade for Norm Snead. And we're going to let you go." And I said, "Gee, what, you got to be kidding me." And I was really shocked. But in the long run, it was the best thing that happened to me.
That's true.
Because it gave me an opportunity to start fresh again.
Yeah, and it was great for Washington because the team was still bad. And you couldn't build through free agency then. You didn't have that. And they were so far behind in what they had been doing since they had only white players up until 1962 that it was going to take some time to do that. But with Bobby Mitchell, they taken Charlie Taylor the same year that Sonny came here, Jerry Smith, and they had some weapons for him. Never really had a running game. The offensive line was just so-so, but Sonny was such a great passer that he made it fun to go out to first D.C. Stadium and then, after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, RFK Stadium. And while they didn't win a lot, Sonny kept it exciting, and that was a great thing for all of us. Now, in that first year that he played here, 1964, and traded in the division too, which is really, it's not even like Donovan McNabb traded here, because McNabb was at the end. Sonny was in the absolute prime of his career. He's like 28, 29 years old when he comes here, and it's like, wow, why would Philadelphia do that? But okay, if you're going to do that, you're going to pay. And Sonny goes back to, it was then Franklin Field. They weren't playing at the Vet yet. That didn't open until 70 or 71. So it's Franklin Field, where he had played for the Eagles for 7 years. Yeah, been 7 years in Philadelphia. Some of that sitting behind Norm Van Brocklin. But that was his home field, and he came back and he conquered.
When you're playing a team that released you, or a team that ended up letting you go for some reason or another, you want to go back and prove to them they made a mistake. And in the first game back, I threw 5 touchdown passes against them, and we beat them. And that felt good, you know? It's like, hey, okay, you didn't like me? How you like me now?
You think? Threw 5 touchdown passes. Oh, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have let that guy go. Maybe that guy was pretty good. A year later, playing Dallas. Now, Dallas took some years to build. They came in as an expansion team in 1960, and they were ramping up. But by 1965, they were a team good enough to play in the NFL championship game against the Green Bay Packers. They played them for the this was the year before the Ice Bowl. People remember that most. That was a game that was played in Green Bay. But in 1965, they played the championship game in Dallas, and the Packers beat them and went on to play in the first Super Bowl against Kansas City. So Dallas was a good team, and Washington predictably had fallen behind them until Sonny brought them back.
Sonny Jurgensen, one of the foremost bombardiers in the NFL, led the Redskins to their most impressive victory against the Cowboys in D.C. Stadium. Behind 21-0 in the first half, Jurgensen faces the unenviable task of fighting an uphill battle. Charlie Taylor revitalizes the Redskins with this 38-yard reception. Jurgensen spears Taylor again between two Cowboys, and the streamlined back dives into the end zone to put the Redskins on the scoreboard.
Yeah, so there were some highlights there, but more often than not, Sonny would throw a bunch of touchdown passes, and the defense was so bad, they would lose the game. So they have years under Otto Graham in the mid-60s, and Otto Graham was kind of like Spurrier without the same personality, but he really didn't have a great coaching background. He was a great player in the NFL, won a bunch of championships for the Cleveland Browns, But his coaching experience was at the Coast Guard Academy, hardly the highest level of college football. And he was hired here by Edward Bennett Williams because he thought, well, you know, we got this great quarterback in Sonny Jurgensen. Let's get another great quarterback and someone who has coached some so that we can have him learn. And so that didn't work out. You know, they were scoring a bunch of points, and they had that famous 72-41 win over the Giants, but they had a losing record all 3 years that Otto Graham coached. And so in 1969, here comes somebody who could, many thought, walk on water. In fact, when he was introduced as the head coach in February of 1969, Vince Lombardi said, despite popular opinion, I did not come here by walking across the Potomac. But this was a marriage made in heaven between Sonny Jurgensen and Vince Lombardi. In fact, Lombardi was asked at his opening news conference, well, what do you think about Sonny Jurgensen? He said, well, Sonny's a great quarterback, but his arm is going to fall off before we become a championship team. And then he got a look at him in whatever, mini camp. I guess they had mini camp in those days. And he said, oh, my. He said, if we had him in Green Bay, the NFL would have declared us a monopoly. This was Sonny on Lombardi.
I was desperate to have someone like Lombardi come in. He was the only coach that I played for that simplified the game of football.
And I've had many conversations with Sonny about Lombardi over the years, and that's what he said. He said he was so brilliant that it was simple, and he had his best year. His best year of professional football was 1969, where he had close to 60% passing in an era that was much different than now. You're allowed to pretty much tackle the wide receivers. The game was a lot different, and to throw, complete 60% of your passes was remarkable at that time. And the team was good. I mean, in an instant, Lombardi had turned around the fortunes. They went 7-5-2. Now, they weren't as good as the Dallas Cowboys. They weren't good enough to do that. And there was no wild card in those days. You had to win the division, and they didn't do that. But to have a winning season, they had had, I think, one in the previous like 20 years. So to have a 7-5-2 season was something to really celebrate here. And the future looked so bright. Vince Lombardi was 57 years old. You thought, well, you know, maybe he's going to coach another 10 years. Who knows? And sadly, he was diagnosed with colon cancer and died before the start of the 1970 season. But at the end of 69, after Sonny had his great year, he recalled the conversation that he had with Lombardi.
After the first year, I went into the office, and he was there. And he congratulated me on the first year under him. He said, you didn't even know the system. He said, but you completed 65% of your passes. You set some records. He said, I think now that you know the system, next year you'll complete 70% of your passes. Gee,
unheard of.
He was right. And he said, and I said, but look how many times I got sacked because you told me to hold on to the ball and then throw it. And I said, look how many times I got sacked. He said, yeah, but you knew the personnel better than I did. And laughed and walked out.
Yeah, Sonny had great love for Vince Lombardi. He said, you know, I never played in a Super Bowl, but I feel like I traded that for my one season with Lombardi. Bill Austin coaches the 1970 season. They finished 6-8. And then Edward Bennett Williams does it again. Brings in George Allen. George Allen says, the future is now. And he proves it. He trades all of his draft picks for his veteran players, and the team gets off to a 5-0 start. Unfortunately, it's a 5-0 start without Sonny. They brought in Billy Kilmer. That was one of the first moves that Allen made. He made a trade with the Saints to bring in Kilmer. And Kilmer wasn't happy about that, but he was not going to start in New Orleans anyway because they had drafted Archie Manning, and he's coming to Washington where Sonny is entrenched as the starter, and he says, well, this is great. I'm not going to play. I don't like this. But Sonny broke his shoulder in a preseason game against Miami. He'd thrown an interception, preseason game, should have known better, should have let the guy score, but tried to make a tackle, broke his shoulder, and missed most of that season, and Billy Kilmer took the team to the playoffs for the first time since the 1940s, where they lost a playoff game at San Francisco. Comes back 1972, and they lose an early season game to the Patriots, rookie quarterback and Jim Plunkett, and George Allen makes a change, goes to Sonny Jurgensen. Sonny's playing really well. Middle of the season, they're playing the Giants at Old Yankee Stadium. This is before they built the Meadowlands. Sonny steps in a hole, tore his Achilles, and Billy Kilmer is the quarterback for the team as they go to the Super Bowl. And Sonny's on crutches, and he obviously can't play. And worst of all, George Allen won't even let him stand on the sidelines to kind of help Kilmer during the game. He doesn't want him there. Doesn't even want to look at him. He's banished to the press box where he sits alone for the game. This was Sonny recalling to Andy Ockershausen that awful experience for him watching his team lose Super Bowl VII and not being able to play.
George Allen didn't want me to be on the bench. I was on crutches. I'll never forget standing on the sidelines.
The Coliseum, right?
Los Angeles. The Coliseum. And I walked by, they were playing the Miami Dolphins, and I walked by Don Shula, was standing there.
The coach of the Miami Dolphins.
Miami Dolphins coach. And he said, Sonny, I'm sorry you're not going to play in this game. He said, it would be a better game if you could be in it. He said, but I know how hard you worked to get here. And I said, nope, can't do it. So they put me up in a booth.
I remember that way up in the bow, way up top.
It was Jack Kent Cook's box.
He didn't want any distractions, right, George?
That's right. And I could have helped Billy. I really could have.
Well, Billy Kilmer, not good that day. One of his passes to the end zone to Jerry Smith hit the crossbar. In those days, the goalposts were up against the goal line. I don't know why, but now they're further back. That wouldn't have happened. But they shut off Kilmer. The Dolphins challenged Kilmer to beat them. They shut off Larry Brown, who was the MVP of the league that year, and Kilmer couldn't do it. And I think they would have won that game had Sonny been able to play. Anyway, come back for the 1973 season. Sonny's recovered at this point. Kilmer is still the quarterback. And neither one of them is really healthy enough to play all the time. So this controversy that everybody talks about over the years is a little bit clouded by most of the time, or at least some of the time, between the two quarterbacks, one of them wasn't available because of a knee or a shoulder or something. They were aging. It created something a lot of fun in Washington, the bumper stickers. And I think they were put out by this radio station, WMAL. And one bumper sticker said, I root for Washington and I like Sonny. And the other one said, I root for Washington and I like Billy. And they were in burgundy and gold, and people put them on their cars. And it was a huge deal for the 1973 and 1974 seasons. And Sonny, talking to Andy O about it, recalled how he and Billy actually used to have a lot of fun with that.
When Billy and I would go out in my car or in his car, whenever we would see a bumper sticker, if it said, I like Billy, I would give him the bird. And if it said, I like Sonny, he would give him the bird. So we'd flip them off and keep going. And they'd say, that was Jurgensen and Kilmer together there.
Yeah, that was fun days. Fun days in Washington. And the team was beloved. The owner of the team was Edward Bennett Williams, and I don't think anybody really had any strong feelings for him one way or another, other than he had given George Allen a lot of money, and there was no salary cap, and he spent a lot of money, and we had winning teams here, and it were great days. So here we are all these years later. It is, as I said, 48 years since Sonny last played. He never started a playoff game for Washington, and his last pass, he came in off the bench as the then Redskins were losing to the Rams in Los Angeles, the team that George Allen had come from in the playoffs in 1974. And with Kilmer ineffective, George turned to Sonny, and Sonny came in, and he couldn't get it done. And I believe it was the last pass he ever threw was intercepted as a pick six for Isaiah Robertson. And at the end of the season, Sonny really didn't retire, was kind of pushed out the door by George Allen. And there was even some talk that, Sonny might surface in the USFL with the Philadelphia Bell, the World Football League, excuse me, World Football League, which came in 1974. But that didn't happen. He went into broadcasting right away, became a big part of the CBS booth. And in fact, if you listen to the audio from the championship game of, I believe it was 1981, maybe not, but among the championship games were played, Sonny did the color. He worked with Vin Scully. He was the number one analyst for CBS, but I believe at the end of the 1980 season, his contract was not renewed. And his friend Andy Ockershausen said, well, you know, we got a radio booth here with Frank Herzog and Sam Huff. That's a defensive guy and a play-by-play guy. Let's add in a Hall of Fame quarterback. And they did. Well, I mean, he wasn't even in the Hall of Fame yet. Didn't go until 83, but everybody knew that he would get in. And Sonny joined them in the booth, and they were legendary on this station, on this frequency, AM 63, Sonny, Sam, and Frank. Turn down the sound on your television, turn up the radio, and listen to them. So as either a player or a broadcaster, he was in this organization for nearly, or maybe more than 50 years, right? His last year in the booth was 2018, came here in 1964. Yeah, so 54 years minus the years that he was working at CBS. So Sunday number 9 is going to be retired. And I am very fortunate to have seen him play, and even more fortunate to have had a chance to work with him over the years in radio. I'm really looking forward to this, and hopefully this will not be botched like so many of the other things that this organization does. Coming up, Mike Florio with some thoughts on this weekend in the NFL as the league looks to handle what is a very, very tough situation. And you'll hear what Florio has to say about that as we continue.
You met Lala Kent on Vanderpump Rules. Now Lala and her friends share everything on Give Them Lala.
I'm expecting my second child. Which is very, very amazing.
Congratulations.
To say. Feels
We're
that
all
way.
With child.
You can say she's pregnant, she's knocked up, anything except with child.
Oh, I love with child. I'm going to be saying it all the time. Yep. Excuse
yes,
me.
Yes, yes.
6 feet, I'm with child.
Watch what Lala is talking about on YouTube or search for Give Them Lala wherever you listen.
The Andy Pollin Show on ESPN 630 starts right now.
We're at the midway point of my show and really just getting started because Tony's off today, so we're rolling till noon. And I want to get to a lot of what was said yesterday, both by Coach Ron Rivera and by Sam Howell, and the move to make Howell the starter on Sunday. If you're keeping score, that is 28 different starting quarterbacks in the 23 years that Dan Snyder has owned the team. And it is the fifth straight year that they have started three or more quarterbacks. Hadn't worked. The Carson Wentz experiment, dead and buried. 7 games, that's it. Good night. 7 starts. He played in 8 games. Won 2 of them. And wasn't good. Wasn't good. So you move on. But back to the move yesterday. And as we sat here yesterday morning, there were various reports that Taylor Heinicke was going to start against Dallas on Sunday, but that we would see Sam Howell, that Howell would get some playing time in what is a meaningless game for Washington. And I thought that made the most sense because Hal hasn't taken a snap yet. And, you know, allow him to get his feet wet, see what you got. But instead, at the end of practice yesterday, Ron Rivera announced that he's going with Howell. And he did admit that he was thinking about starting Taylor Heinicke, but ultimately went with Howell. And here's where he goes through more of what went into this and how he was thinking and how he made this decision, which I think is a weakness of him as a leader, because you need to be decisive in this job. And it sounds like he did a lot of waffling on this decision.
I had thought about going with Taylor and actually talked to him about that. And then after having an opportunity to rethink and talk with some other folks about it, talk to some of the team leaders and other players and coaches for that matter, it really came down to finding out about the young man. So when I sat down with him, we talked about it. He was excited. And I said, look, you know, just, you know, you're ready? And he was, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready to roll. Well, if you go back and look when Carson was first injured and had surgery, you know, he became the primary backup. So watching Sam every day and getting a chance to watch how he performed against the defense and those little detail things I talked about that I felt he had to work on coming out of training camp, you could see that he was doing those things. He was working. He was getting a feel for that. And a lot of times, you know, when you're doing scout team, you know, that's a good indicator as to how guys can develop and grow. And it was very interesting because a couple of guys that I talked with today, one of the things that they did say was they felt he was ready for his opportunity, and this would be a good chance to watch him. So I think that was a big part of the reason too, as well, is that just how people felt based on the things that we saw, you know, during that stretch, that you know, those 5.5-6 weeks that he was the primary backup. You got a chance to see him compete every day against the number ones.
Maybe other coaches do this. I'm not aware of it. It's not something you poll the players before making the move. And in fact, if he had polled the players before he went to Wentz, I don't think they would have said yes, because all indications from that locker room is they like Heinicke. They like playing for Heinicke more than Wentz. So I don't know I can't imagine. Can you imagine Bill Belichick talking to his players? Yeah, should I make a quarterback change? What do you think? Bill Parcells, you know, any of the great coaches over the years. Got to be decisive. You make the call. It seems to me, I mean, I've never coached in the NFL before. I've never coached anywhere. But it seems odd that you would say, what do you think, guys? Huh? What do you think? I might go with Taylor, but, you know, Sam, he's kind of done some things. Well, yeah. No, make the call. Make the call. You're the coach. Decide what you're going to do. It's Rivera on the attributes of Sam Howell. Now, there's a lot of buzz that he's not picking things up very quickly. And it's been kind of a precipitous fall for Sam Howell over the last couple of years. Had he come out in the 2021 draft, he might have been a first-round pick, might even been a high pick, you know, like in the first 5 or 6 picks. He slides all the way down for 2022 to the 5th round. And Mel Kiper said when he was drafted, this is I'm reading from a Washington Times story, all the numbers came down across the board, but he held the ball too long and had too many passes batted down. He played a little bit short. And then Kiper said, I'm surprised he went in the 5th round. I thought he'd be a 3rd rounder. There's some things he's got to fix to be a starter in the NFL. So the size had a lot to do with him being drafted. You know, that didn't deter, you know, people from taking Kyler Murray, number one overall, things like that. But they looked at him, the slide from his junior year to his senior year, and it just wasn't good. He had good numbers, and he had some huge games. As a sophomore at North Carolina, threw for 550 yards and 6 touchdowns in a game. He led North Carolina to a come-from-behind win over Wake Forest, 59-53. I mean, he's had his moments in college and looked pretty good in the preseason. But, you know, here's a guy that everybody in the league looked at and passed on until he got to the 5th round and was finally taken by Washington. This is what Rivera says he likes about Howell.
One thing we've always felt was he has a live arm. You know, he really does. And quick decision making, and he took pretty good command early on, right from the beginning. Stepped in the huddle and it was really crisp. Broke the huddle real well. I think on the 4th play, there was a somebody had made a mistake in formation in motion, and he stopped it and got back in the huddle and started all over again. So he was willing to step up and take command.
And you mentioned you kind of slept on it after thinking Heinicke. Was there someone in particular that changed your mind or made a point to you that was like, oh, that resonated with you?
There were several people I talked to that gave me some ideas and some thoughts. And I really, you know, I just wanted to make sure I was weighing all the options and opportunities and reasons why. I mean, there's enough reasons why to start him and enough reasons why not to. And it's just a matter of, at the end of the day, he's going to get an opportunity to play. Why not just start from the beginning more so than anything else?
That's not exactly a ringing endorsement. There are as many reasons to not start him as to start him. I don't know if that's something you want to say, but he said it. And we're going into a game against a Cowboy team which has a great pass rush with an offensive line for Washington. And maybe this is one of the reasons that Taylor Heinicke said, oh, yeah, this is great. You know, the kid's going to get an opportunity. I'm thrilled for him. It was Heinicke saying, yeah, I don't want a part of this. I'm going to be a free agent. I don't want to be injured. I want to be healthy going into the offseason. I've put my resume out there. I've played well over the last 3 years, including that playoff loss to Tampa 2 years ago. So, we got nothing to play for here. We're not going anywhere. And Dallas has something to play for. So rather than me get the crap beat out of me by the Cowboys front four, let the kid do it. Let's see how he does. Now, he's going to be the backup, and hopefully Hal lasts in this game, but Hal is going to get the start. This is Hal's, you know, not a ball of fire at these news conferences. Maybe he's going to pick up a little bit here, but he's pretty low key. And again, look kind of chunky. Maybe that's not a big deal, but didn't really have that lean quarterback look, and maybe that's not his look anyway. But he was asked about what he has learned spending the season as a backup, mostly third stringer here.
I just feel like I've learned so much throughout this year, and I really can't talk about one thing. I've really learned so much just from watching the games and seeing how Taylor goes about his business and seeing how Carson goes about his business, just from those two. And those two guys have been so great to me this whole entire year. And even today at practice, they were awesome to me. And so I'm just so blessed to be in a room with those guys, and they've really, you know, helped me come a long way in my development.
And not surprisingly, Hal said he's excited for this opportunity. This is on the big challenge that he's facing Sunday.
Just trying to get up to game speed. You know, I think game speed always is a little different. And I mean, I haven't played a game since the preseason, but I've been staying locked in mentally through the games and trying to play the game from the sideline each and every game. You know, it can be hard at times, but I feel like I've done a good job of that all year long. So I feel like I'll be all right.
All right, well, we'll see. It's Dallas. You know, Dallas with something to play for, possibly the division title. This is his goal. Asked what his goal is for Sunday.
To win. You know, obviously the situation is what it is. You know, we're kind of out of the whole playoff race, but, you know, I don't take any games for granted. You know, this game is the most important game of my life, and it should be the most important game of everybody on the team's life. You know, it's our next game, and that's the mentality I have, and the mentality I'm trying to get across to my teammates as well. You know, we're playing to win. You know, no matter if we can't go to the playoffs, it's a game in the NFL. It's, you know, what we all work for, coaches too. You know, they all dreamed of coaching the NFL, so we're going to go out there and give it our all.
Good luck with that. So we'll see. We'll see. It's on Sunday. Terry McLaurin, you know, he's what, 20, he's going to be 27 next year. He's been here now for 4 years. See, first year, 19, 20, 21, 20. Yeah, this is fourth season. He's going into his fifth year, and it's just been a parade of quarterbacks. I mean, every time he turns around, there's a new guy as a starter. As I say, that's the fifth straight year that they have had at least three different starting quarterbacks. But, you know, he's a mensch. I can't stress enough how impressed I am every time I hear him talk, every time I see him interviewed. And so they go to him in the locker room yesterday after the announcement is made that it's going to be Hal. And of course, Terry McLaurin takes the high road.
I'm excited to be there and support Sam. I've seen some really good things out of him this year. Not only just in preseason, I know preseason is preseason, but the way he's handled the scout teams and the reps that he's gotten when Carson was down and he was possibly the backup for Taylor. You know, he makes some throws that the ball comes off his arm. You're just like, wow, that's a nice ball he just threw. And he has really good touch. And I think he has a quiet confidence about him. So I'm really excited to see how he is in a game-like atmosphere.
I don't know how much of McLaurin that Howell is going to get because Ron Rivera did say that they were going to look at some younger players. Maybe Dax Milne gets a bunch of snaps. He hadn't done much as a returner this year. So maybe – and he did play some receiver last year, looked impressive at times. And, you know, there's really no chemistry between – McLaurin and Hal because they don't really practice together. I mean, you know, when Hal has run the offense, he's running the scout team, and obviously McLaurin's not on that. So There really isn't a lot of timing between the two of them. And you know, that was a problem with Wentz, too, that Wentz and McLaurin never clicked in the time here. And that was another problem with Wentz, your best receiver, and you never got on the same page, really, with him. So I don't know how much of McLaurin and Howell hooking up we're going to see, but we're going to give it a shot, right? They're going to give it a shot. We're going to see what happens on Sunday afternoon when Washington plays. Coming up, something that Ron Rivera said yesterday at the end of his news conference, which you and I might have a little quibble with, and I'll look at what Barry Zberluga wrote about this as well as we continue. It's the Andy Polin Show, ESPN 630.
You met Lala Kent on Vanderpump Rules. Now Lala and her friends share everything on Give Them Lala.
I'm expecting my second child. Which is very, very amazing to say.
Congratulations.
Feels
We're
that
all
way.
With child.
You can say she's pregnant, she's knocked up, anything except with child.
Oh, I love with child. I'm going to be saying it all the time. Yep. Excuse
yes,
me.
Yes, yes.
6 feet, I'm with child.
Watch what Lala is talking about on YouTube or search for Give Them Lala wherever you listen.
The Andy Polin Show on ESPN 630, the sports capital.
We're in for Tony today, so a lot of time left. Going until noon today. Tony is back tomorrow. And we've spent some time on the quarterback move made yesterday. Kind of a surprise because at this time yesterday, it was being reported that Taylor Heinicke was going to start and Sam Howell was going to play. And then we found out after practice that, in fact, Sam Howell is going to start. I'll talk more about that in the next hour. But something that Ron Rivera said at the end of his news conference that I want to delve into a little bit. Remember when he came here, we had an uncertain quarterback situation for the Commanders. Dwayne Haskins had played his rookie year in 2019 for a coaching staff that changed in the middle of the season as Jay Gruden got fired after 5 games. The staff didn't really want him. The word was that he wasn't spending the time to learn the offense well enough. And he had some moments in his rookie year, but, you know, some moments that were also things you looked at and said, there's a maturity problem here. Like, you know, when they had a game locked up against the Lions and he needed to take a knee on the final snap and he was taking selfies in the stands. And, you know, just other things that players were talking about behind the scenes. And Ron Rivera had to bench him after 4 games, had to go back to him for a variety of reasons. But ultimately, caught him at the end of the season. And here's Taylor Heinicke out of nowhere who comes in and they make the playoffs and they lose a playoff game to Tampa Bay. And even by Rivera's own admission, they lucked into that. You know, that was a year where Dallas and Philadelphia had injuries and they were playing quarterbacks who were long out of the league now. I mean, it was just an odd circumstance in the NFC East that year that 7-9 was good enough to win the division. And then last year, they figure, okay, with Ryan Fitzpatrick, we'll be competitive enough to make the playoffs, and we'll see what happens from there. We're only spending $10 million on him, and he's been a starting quarterback before, and we'll see if we can, you know, kind of move forward with Heinicke as the backup behind him and see how things develop. Well, that didn't work out either, as they only got 16 snaps from him before his season and career was over. Fitzpatrick retired at the end of the season, and Heinicke was good at times, but not good enough to make the playoffs. So another year, 7-10. Rivera reminded everybody, you know, it's year 3 that really makes the difference. I mean, look at my record. I had some struggles my first couple of years in Carolina, and then we went to the Super Bowl in year 3. So this is the year we make the big step up. Well, going into the last game of the season, they have 7 wins, just as they've had the last 2 years. They have a chance, I guess. Well, they will at least finish a half game better than last year because of the tie. But the reality is they're looking at a third straight 7-win season. And at the news conference yesterday, my friend Scott Abraham asked him the question, you said that year 3 was a step-up year. Do you feel like you have made a step up in year number 3?
I'd like to believe we did. I think we did some really good things. I think there was a point where, what, we were 6 in the whole playoff hunt. We got ourselves there. We played some pretty good football, and some things happened that we just couldn't sustain. You know, we went through a period with some injuries and lost some guys for the season that we didn't have available. We've played several games that way. We didn't have the running backs from the very beginning. We finally got that together, and as things came together, we showed what we could do, and then some unfortunate situations. So do I think we step forward? Yeah, I do. Do I think we show we have a pretty good core of young guys? Yes, I think so. And do we have enough young guys, our veteran guys around those young guys? I think we do. But I do think there's a couple positions that we can shore up, that we need to shore up. And again, it comes back to the one question that's looming over everybody, and that's the quarterback position. I was kind of hoping that, you know, we had found a solution, and who knows? We may not. We may have. We'll find out on Sunday how we feel about it coming out of it. But do I feel good enough? Yeah, I do. I really do. I mean, we did some good things, you'd like to believe. Now, we had some opportunities we didn't capitalize, and that's on us. That's on me. But at the end of the day, I feel good about it.
Well, not everybody feels good about it. Tom Lavero, Washington Times yesterday, mentioning that the move last week to Carson Wentz is a fireable offense. Barry Zbruglia, the column today in the Washington Post, Rivera hasn't been the solution, but a change might not be possible, subheadline. He writes, he chose Carson Wentz as his quarterback to start the season and Carson Wentz as his quarterback with the season in the balance. Both decisions stunk. He didn't know that a loss Sunday put his team in peril of being eliminated from playoff contention until after his team lost and was in such peril. He mismanages the clock and his timeouts more than you would like, and he boldly said his team needed to take a step forward in the third year, only to have been decidedly stuck in neutral. He writes, the damning elements of Ron Rivera's tenure as coach of Washington's NFL franchise have added up. In a normal town with a normal team, with a normal time, firing him with 2 years left on a five-year deal would seem, well, normal. And that's not going to happen, as he points out, because of the uncertain situation with ownership. You know, is Snyder going to go through the interview process, hiring his 11th head coach, only to hand that off to a new owner, not to mention the 2 years that would be left on Rivera's contract? Now, here's some numbers. Here's some numbers on Rivera. Maybe you've heard these. They've been thrown around a lot, that he's had only three winning seasons during his tenure. He says, between his nine-year tenure in Carolina and his three seasons in Washington, he has now coached 189 regular season NFL games and posted a 5.19 win percentage, just over 50%. Of the 42 men who have coached more games, according to the data at Pro Football Reference, only eight have won at a lower rate. That fact illustrates the obvious. To coach for that long, you have to win. Dig in on those numbers a little deeper. Rivera's dozen seasons have ended with a winning record just three times, a 25% rate. 25% of the time you have a winning season. A winning season, come on. I mean, winning season nowadays, you got a pretty good shot at the playoffs. He's won just 25% of the time. No one who has coached more games has a lower rate of winning seasons, though Sam Weiss, who took the Bengals to a Super Bowl and later coached in Tampa Bay, also went 3-for-12. Lovie Smith, Lou Saban, John Gruden, Norv Turner, Marvin Lewis, Weeb Eubank, and Jeff Fisher all coach more games than Rivera and won at a lower percentage, but all seven of those coaches posted winning records more often. What we have then is a documented record of mediocrity. Upon his hiring, Rivera represented a sort of steel-jawed stability. He brought a dignity the franchise desperately needed. He stood tall during his own fight with cancer, setting an example as a standard. It was and is admirable, but he does not win and has not won consistently. It didn't happen in Carolina, where he was eventually fired by a new owner. It hasn't happened in Washington, where he is 21-27-1. Won a division title with a losing record in year one, had a playoff spot in his grasp, but went 0-3-1 with a bungled quarterback switch in year three. So, you know, Mike Wilbon, you're going to hear that coming up at 11 o'clock. He also says Ron Rivera should be fired. He loves Rivera because Rivera played on the 85 Bears, his favorite team of all time. But that's where we are with this coach, and you kind of stuck with him for at least another year, it looks like. I mean, unless something really, really crazy happens, like, you know, they firm up the sale in the next few weeks, but the owners have to approve him as whoever it is, he or she as the new owner, in March. March would be the earliest. That's when the next time they're due to meet. So, you know, is that time? I guess you could conceivably fire Ron Rivera at that point and bring in a new coach. But more than likely, you're going to roll with them because the work will have been done. I mean, Rivera and the two Martys, they're going to do all the research on the players that they're going to look at. The combine will have already happened at that point. The draft will be about a month away. I mean, it's not really a good time to do that. So as mediocre as this has been, and look, you know, Rivera has had to deal with a lot, including, as Barry mentioned, cancer. And he's also had to deal with ownership issues that I don't even – he knew this was a problem situation. I mean, this he knew what he's getting into in Washington. But shortly after he arrives, the Washington Post does all that reporting about sexual harassment in the organization, the congressional investigation – all those things. Now he brought in some of his own trouble too. You know, Ryan Vermilion, his handpicked trainer, investigated by the DEA, had to cut a deal with them not to go to jail. I mean, there's a lot of things that he did too. But this is as bad a situation as there is in professional sports. And I don't know how well anybody would handle it, but as Barry points out here, you got a coach who, aside from going to the Super Bowl in his third year, has proven to be mediocre prior to his time here. And in his time here, doesn't get much more mediocre than 21-27-1, does it? With one backed-in playoff appearance, and they lost, although they played pretty well in that game. But, you know, close only counts, as we say, in hand grenades and horseshoes. All right, next hour, we'll talk more about the quarterback change. Tony and Mike weighed in on it on PTI yesterday. I also want to do a little tribute to Sonny Jurgensen. If you missed that in the 9 o'clock hour, Sonny's number is going to be retired Sunday when the Commanders play, hopefully with some Commanders fans in attendance. And I will talk about his career and his 11-year run here in Washington and much more as we continue with the Tony Kornheiser Show next.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.